Hello, you're listening to an episode of Trade Talks, a podcast about the economics of trade policy. I'm Samaya Keynes, the Trade and Globalization Editor for The Economist.
And I'm Chad Bown, a senior fellow with the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
For all listeners who have been living under a rock for the last few weeks, the WTO has a new Director General, Dr. Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala.
I think first and foremost, we need to focus on the issue of COVID-19 and what can the WTO do to contribute to solutions.
In this episode, we're going to explore the accusation that the WTO rules have been making the pandemic response harder. A group of members claim that the WTO's intellectual property rules are too tight and that normal protections of intellectual property should be suspended until most people in the world are vaccinated.
We are going to explain what these rules are, as well as the real constraints on companies and governments. We will be joined by two special guests.
I'm Rachel Silverman, and I'm a policy fellow working on global health at the Center for Global Development.
My name is Tom Boyke, and I'm the director of the Global Health Program at the Council on Foreign Relations.
Let's start off with the basics. The part of the WTO rules that everyone is talking about is this thing called TRIPS, or the Agreement on Trade-Related Aspects of Intellectual Property Rights. The baseline rule is that members have to offer at least 20 years of intellectual property protection from the time that someone files for a patent.
Just to give a bit of context for how this got into the WTO, essentially in the 1980s, you had America decide it was going to enforce intellectual property rules unilaterally. So it was going around the world saying, hey, we don't like the way you're treating IP. We're going to threaten you and convince you to treat it in the way that we want. And so essentially negotiators in all these other countries were like, oh, this isn't very pleasant. We want to bring this into the multilateral system so we don't have America doing its own thing. Now, that said, there was a reluctance to go too far. Sure, you want companies to have this incentive to invest, fine. But if you hand too much power, too much control to the IP holder, you are essentially stifling competition and you are screwing over consumers.
So the protection of intellectual property gets brought into the trading system in 1995 when the WTO gets into effect. And almost immediately, things go very, very wrong. So this was the period of the HIV and AIDS crisis, and pharmaceutical companies had developed patented antiretroviral therapies, but these therapies weren't being made available to poor countries. There were companies that could manufacture these products in those poor countries, but without breaking the patent rules, consumers just weren't going to be allowed to buy them. And meanwhile, you had millions of people who were becoming infected and dying.
Now, in emergencies, there are flexibilities. So governments are allowed to issue these things called compulsory licenses. And here they basically say, hey, it's an emergency. We cannot wait around for the patent holder to grant us a license to make this drug. Look, we'll pay the patent holder, but we're not going to respect the patent. We're going to issue this compulsory license and a company is going to make the drugs for cheaper.
In theory, governments could use compulsory licenses under the rules, but in practice, there was huge pressure that was coming from these pharmaceutical companies on the governments not to actually use them. In one case in particular that stood out, the pharmaceutical companies actually sued Nelson Mandela and the South African government to try to prevent them from doing so.
In 2001, WTO members got together and they made this thing called the Doha Declaration. And that said, members of the WTO, you can decide when there is an emergency. You can grant these compulsory licenses. In 2003, there was actually an amendment to the rules so that countries that couldn't produce the drugs themselves were able to import cheaper generic drugs made under a compulsory license from these third countries. Over time, the drugs became more widely available, prices dropped. And, you know, this humanitarian catastrophe was resolved. Here's Rachel.
So this is the example that's often cited, and it is a very real example. And even pharma, big pharma, acknowledges that their behavior in this situation was a mistake, that it had tragic consequences, and that it's actually come up in this pandemic as well.
This topic of IP protection and global public health is a long-running issue. There are a lot of really big commercial interests. Those folks tend to want tighter IP protection. And there are advocates out there who have been campaigning for years saying that these things are already too tight.
Now, I want to say right now that this episode is not whether global IP rules are too tight overall. And actually, it is the case that you have the WTO IP rules, and then you have this kind of overlapping mishmash of bilateral deals, and often there the rules are much tighter. And you know, I personally have some sympathy for the folks complaining about the market power of large pharmaceutical companies. And there are clearly examples, like with HIV/AIDS, where it went horribly, horribly wrong. All that said, the narrower question we're going to be answering here is whether the WTO's rules are a problem when tackling this pandemic, when tackling COVID-19.
So let's talk about COVID-19. We asked Rachel how intellectual property has been a problem during this pandemic.
So in the first months of the pandemic, when we were really all in a global emergency stage, if you recall, there were many disputes over importation, for example, of N95 masks or making enough tests for this for coronavirus to detect the disease. And all countries were scrambling to get enough of these basic supplies, personal protective equipment and testing. At this point, we didn't really have any therapeutics that we knew to work. We didn't have vaccines. We were just trying to detect spread and stop transmission. And there were a few cases in which IP started to be problematic, at least on the margins. So the ones you often hear cited are that patent holders for N95 masks seem to invoke their intellectual property in a way that may have dissuaded production of those masks by, for example, 3D printers or other generic manufacturers. The other commonly cited example was around the chemical reagents for various kinds of testing, that some of those were under patent. The patent holders were reluctant to give up that tech. I think eventually they were pressured to do so and did. But in the short term, that was a bit of a dispute.
That was early on in the pandemic, and things do seem to have evolved over time.
So in maybe the summer, we started to talk about therapeutics. There was remdesivir, which was a drug licensed or patented by Gilead Sciences. Ultimately, it was shown to have a fairly marginal effect and probably does not need to be used in broad quantities. But in the short term, there was some hope it would be a highly effective therapy. And it was under patent, and they were not necessarily eager to give up that patent right away. There was then very good news that the first thing that we found that really was quite effective was a off-patent steroid. And this was widely produced by generic producers, so even poor countries could get it without much of a problem. So that was considered very good news for global access. And then we've entered a new phase where these monoclonal antibodies are under patent, appear to be effective to some extent. And again, this is a little bit reinvigorated, the debate about patents, although not clear to what extent patents are the barrier here, as even the originators are having trouble scaling production in the quantities that were desired. And this has been a bit of a political football in the US and elsewhere.
Things have really heated up with all the talk of vaccines.
Early on, before there was any vaccine, UNAIDS and the WHO and others put out a call for a people's vaccine, preemptively raising this point that maybe IP would be a barrier to broad access. At this point, there was no vaccine, so it was a little bit of a hypothetical, right? There were many vaccine candidates in development, but none that had been shown to be effective. But they basically called for a world in which this people's vaccine was open to everyone, that it was not subject to some of these intellectual property restrictions, and, you know, therefore it could be broadly manufactured and made available to all. And that campaign around the people's vaccine has picked up steam over time, especially as things have proven effective and have come to market. Especially these first two vaccines that were approved, the Pfizer BioNTech vaccine and Moderna, where most of the supply had been pre-ordered by wealthy countries. So that raised broad concerns about vaccine equity and really reinvigorated the enthusiasm behind addressing some of these vaccine issues.
All this has been happening, and there are some out there who think that the WTO rules are a problem. In October of 2020, India and South Africa approached the WTO with a proposal. Essentially, they want a TRIPS waiver for all COVID-related products. So that's therapies, that's diagnostics, personal protective equipment, vaccines. That means basically no IP associated with them that could stop generic manufacturers from making them. So no copyright, no protection for trade secrets, no patents, no protections for industrial designs. The government wouldn't even have to issue a compulsory license and pay the IP holder. The manufacturers could just go for it. And the idea is that this would last until vaccines are in place globally and the majority of the world's population is immune. So if you think about TRIPS as having these little doors that you can climb through to escape a health emergency, right, like the compulsory licenses, this waiver is like taking a bazooka and blasting four holes in the wall. Now, India and South Africa say, you know, chill out. This waiver would be temporary. It could be reviewed every year. But it's clearly much more blunt than the existing flexibilities in the deal.
Some governments have signed on as co-sponsors, and that includes a major boost in February when more than 50 countries in Africa signed on. But unsurprisingly, the big rich countries, the ones that have all those pharmaceutical companies with all of that IP, they are not in favor.
Okay, before we get on to the criticisms, let's talk about why you would want this waiver. So why might this waiver be a good idea?
So the arguments in favor of the waiver are in the context of the pandemic. This is a global emergency. No one is safe until we are all safe. Many of these products were developed in part with public money. That's often pointed out, especially the vaccines, which had tremendous investments of public money. And the argument is that, well, we should not be allowing companies to profiteer from these products in a pandemic at the expense of people's health and ending the pandemic. We're not safe until we're all safe. And I think that basic argument that we're not safe until we're all safe is correct. And there is a global imperative to ensure broad access. So then the debate is about whether this waiver would actually have that effect of increasing production or decreasing prices and pushing equitable access. So the advocates argue that historically, patents have been a large barrier to generic competition, have kept prices high, have precluded access to medicine, especially in poor countries, that there are generic producers across the global south who have the capacity to make vaccines if they weren't constrained in this way. That, again, companies should not necessarily expect big profits during a pandemic when they did not take on much personal risk because they were heavily subsidized in their R&D by governments. And that they should open it up to everyone, that if they opened it up to everyone, there would be more vaccine at lower prices, and we'd have this people's vaccine that could be shared with everyone. That's what they would argue.
I spoke to Jamie Love and Thiru Balasubramaniam of Knowledge Ecology International. And I don't think they thought that this was the number one priority right now, but they were in favor of this proposal. And one reason was that even though there are these flexibilities written into the WTO rules, there is a huge amount of pressure applied to countries not to use them. Remember, there was those companies applying pressure around the time of HIV/AIDS. Even after that, there are examples where the soft law is more important than the hard law. So the idea is by having this waiver, you remove that stigma, that disincentive to use the TRIPS flexibilities. Another thing Jamie Love said was that, you know, some people say, oh, this is a slippery slope and this would be setting a bad precedent. And he was like, the slope is very steep, right? There are very strong commercial interests in keeping these things, these protections in place. So if it's written into the waiver that it will be temporary, then you really can expect it to be temporary.
Let's talk about the arguments against the waiver. Or maybe more generally, why WTO rules aren't constraining the fight against the pandemic.
So one argument against is, I'd say, the maybe pharmacy industry perspective, which generally speaking argues in favor of patents or intellectual property protections. So one part is the incentives for innovation, right? That this is how they make their money. They put a lot of money at risk into upfront research and development. You can say that in this case, that was subsidized by the US government, by the European governments and the UK. It was, that's certainly true. But Moderna, for example, had been building up this platform of basic research, this foundational platform for many years before the pandemic hit, right? And the idea is that, well, it was the promise of patents, of the potential to have that protected monopoly that allows them to profit for a set duration of time, that enabled those upfront investments in R&D that were then the foundational platform on which they built this vaccine. So they would say patents are important to protect incentives for innovation and create this robust innovation ecosystem.
Those arguments are pretty familiar, but they're maybe not that helpful in the current context. There's clearly a point at which you say, look, the hit to your incentives is worth it because we need to save lives. The innovation point shouldn't give companies license to claim whatever level of protection they want.
I'd say there are a second set of arguments specifically around this pandemic and this particular context. The first is quality control and quality assurance. So some of these vaccines probably could be produced by generic producers. So those would be the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine, the J&J, the Novavax. Some of these already have been licensed to generic producers. But the idea is they're currently licensed through voluntary processes with sort of tech transfer and oversight. If you took away that layer and you basically said, here's a recipe, anybody who wants to can produce it, there would not be that layer of quality control. And it's possible that many companies would be able to do it and institute that quality control. But if one company, let's say, took shortcuts and produced a subpar vaccine, that vaccine entered the supply and there were problems associated with it, not only would that be bad, of course, for the people who got that vaccine, but it would undermine global confidence in vaccination in a context where we already have quite a bit of vaccine hesitancy. So the issues around quality control and oversight of the production lines, originator companies, when they hold the licenses, obviously have a strong interest in quality control. If you open that up broadly and they're no longer involved in that process at all, there may not be that same kind of incentive and oversight. And then the second question is just a very practical question of, is what the advocates say true, that if you removed this these patent barriers, you would suddenly have widespread generic production? And I think what I would argue, and what many others, some others would argue, is that that's not true.
This question, would the waiver actually stimulate production? That's the important one. Here's Tom.
Patents are a bargain meant to be for the public good. In exchange for being able to exclude people from making something, it provides the incentive for people to do research and development to make socially useful products. So you have the ability to recoup your investment. But there's another piece of this that people often forget. You have to disclose how you made it so that people, once the patent expires, can make it too, and so that you advance the field. The part that's unusual about particularly vaccines is because people rush to file patents so early, they often haven't worked out the manufacturing yet. So none of that information is included in that disclosure. So what you often have is you have information about what they're going to try to do with the vaccine, but no ability for anyone else to make it. So you have historically this big problem around biologicals like vaccines on this knowledge transfer. And it's something that really does take a lot of work and it takes some facilitation.
Vaccines really aren't like other drugs. Here's Rachel.
So if you think about normal generic manufacturing, you're generally talking about a chemical compound, right? And the reason it's under patent is because it's not actually that hard to make the chemical compound. This is often what you hear, that the marginal cost of production is extremely low. The cost is in the research and development. The cost is in running the trials that prove it works in the first place, right? And discovering that this would work for this application and going through that lengthy process. But the molecule itself, the chemical molecule, is not that difficult to produce. And it's very obvious what it is. You know, you can look at it, you can figure out what the molecule is. That's public domain knowledge. And so then you just have to reverse engineer how to make it. Right? You know the molecule works. It's something of a challenge to figure out how to reverse engineer it, but it's very much within the capacity of most generic producers if given a little bit of time and ability to do that. If you think about vaccines, they're not just a chemical molecule, right? They're a complex biological product. I mean, think about the Moderna and Pfizer BioNTech vaccines. There is mRNA, right? There is genetic code in there that has to be synthesized and replicated through a complex biological process. Then that is itself has to be suspended in these like lipids, these, you know, special fat cells. Again, I'm not a, you know, microbiologist or vaccinologist, so talk to them for the details of the process. But the biological synthesization process is much more difficult than just reverse engineering a chemical compound.
With those new complicated mRNA vaccines especially, you really do need the cooperation of the originating companies, the Modernas, the Pfizers, to be able to transfer all the know-how. You can waive all the patents in the world, and the other companies just still aren't going to be able to make this stuff. And there's also personnel constraints. These mRNA vaccines are so new, there just aren't that many people in the world that know how the new ones are being made in the plant. And the people that do know how they're made, well, they're a bit busy right now trying to scale up their production as fast as they can. This really isn't like the HIV/AIDS crisis of 20 years ago.
When I lived in South Africa at the time and was working on these issues, only 10,000 people had access. What people sometimes confuse in the case of access to medicines is they think that problem that you had in South Africa around HIV is going to be the dynamic for every medicine issue, that it's going to be a patent issue that is keeping access or keeping prices high. And that's not the case. What you had in South Africa is you had a medicine that South Africa had local manufacturing, other countries could make it too, and it was really just the patents that were keeping it from being able to be made domestically. Vaccine manufacturing is totally different. Where it is scarce, it does have this capacity issue. So that's the part that people don't understand.
When it comes to expanding vaccine production today, the constraints are the transfer of know-how. There's also just basic manufacturing capacity. There's logistical problems that are being worked out. It's that sort of thing. Now, that's not to say that there's no tech transfer going on. There are voluntary license agreements happening. So you know, if you're a generic manufacturer in an emerging market, I do think there should be opportunities for productive, collaborative relationships with the vaccine originators. And so far, I haven't heard about any generic producers approaching the originators, asking to license the IP and being refused. Now, when we're talking about more traditional vaccines or other products, say diagnostics or what have you, the situation is a little different. There, the complexity point is just less compelling. But there, the argument is that maybe we don't need this waiver. Maybe we should just use the flexibilities that are built into the WTO TRIPS agreement. You should just use compulsory licenses. I was also talking to Rod Hunter, who actually helped to negotiate the TRIPS amendment in 2003. And he said, absolutely no other WTO member is going to take a WTO case challenging a compulsory license in the middle of a pandemic. It's just not going to happen. I also spoke to Brian Mercurio, who's a law professor at the Chinese University of Hong Kong. And he made the point that where countries hadn't used compulsory licenses, the problem wasn't actually often with the WTO rules, it was with their domestic law. They just hadn't changed their laws to allow for these compulsory licenses. So, you know, complain, get the law changed, but not necessarily the WTO.
And there are examples of countries during the pandemic that have changed their compulsory licensing laws quickly when they needed to do so. And that would include rich countries like the UK, France, and Germany. And in March of last year, Israel actually issued a compulsory license for the drug Keletra to treat patients with COVID-19. Now, you could say, well, that's complicated and a barrier to poorer countries using these licenses. But even with the waiver, you'd probably have to change your domestic law to be able to take advantage of it. So it's not like the waiver would be legally straightforward and using existing flexibilities would be impossibly complicated. We asked Tom whether he thought the advocates of this waiver were really trying to address the pandemic or whether they were actually just trying to weaken rules that they didn't like even before the pandemic.
I'm not going to question the motives of governments that have proposed this waiver, but I do think casting it so broadly has limited the ability of governments that might otherwise support a more targeted solution to the instances where patents or copyright or other intellectual property really is the limiting factor to access to medicines. This proposal applies so broadly to different forms of intellectual property for such a long period of time, for so many different types of technologies, that it really excludes the possibility of that targeted approach to get the medical technologies to people that might benefit from the most.
Here's Rachel on what she would like to see.
So what I would love to see is advocates directing their energies in a bit more of a constructive and cooperative way with pharma versus a confrontational posture. So one thing they could do, and to their credit, some are already doing this, so it's not to say none of this is happening already, is to constructively pressure pharmaceutical companies to undertake more proactive licensing and tech transfer deals with generic manufacturers. So to be that cooperative, constructive, proactive partner in expanding manufacturing.
We both watched Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala's press conference on February 15th as the newly appointed WTO Director General.
We are losing lives in all countries all over the world. But in poor countries, if we don't act, more lives will be lost. So what I'm going to try to do is to meet with members on all sides who are having these arguments about intellectual property issues and try to see if we can find, again, I come back, I've named it the third way, simply because I think we can find a way to be very, very conscious that we need to encourage research and development, because if you don't, then we wouldn't have more investment even into looking at the variants of this.
she also wanted to look at existing flexibilities in TRIPS and support pharmaceutical companies as they license production of vaccines.
If the objective is agreeable and acceptable, that poor countries should not wait in line and wait long to get access, because it's not even in the interest of rich countries, then we can try to figure out a way to do this. And I'm saying that I would like to be able to broker, you know, this by listening to both sides, what I call a third way, in which without impinging on intellectual property, looking at the flexibilities that are available, which I think will allow us to manufacture and produce those the vaccines, therapeutics, and diagnostics by working with the manufacturers of these, the pharmaceutical companies. I think we can do it.
In conclusion here, there is still a lot to do, and there's a lot of problems that have to be solved. And when the WTO's TRIPS agreement gets between the world's poor and the vaccine, be sure I'll be at the front leading the protest. But I just don't think that's where we are right now. And that is all for Trade Talks. A huge thank you to Tom Boyke at the Council on Foreign Relations. Tom has spent far too much time teaching me about pandemics, therapeutics, diagnostics, vaccines, and everything health related during the crisis. And also a big thanks to Rachel Silverman of the Center for Global Development.
Huge thanks to Tom and Rachel from me too. Thanks also for comments and suggestions from Rod Hunter of Baker McKenzie, Jamie Love and Thiru Balasubramaniam of Knowledge Ecology International, Brian Mercurio of the Chinese University of Hong Kong, and everyone else who would rather not be named. I really am very grateful.
And as always, thanks to Colin Warren, our audio guy.
Do follow us on Twitter. I'm at Samaya Keynes.
And I'm at Chad Bown.
And we're on @trade__talks.
That's not one, but two underscores, @trade__talks.